This fire engineering podcast is made possible by Tenkata Protective Fabrics. The global leader in flame-resistant fabrics, Tenkata Protective Fabrics enables millions of people worldwide to be great at what they do. Generations of industry professionals serving in the fire service, industrial, and military industries rely on Tenkata Fabrics for safety, comfort, and confidence. From the harshest working conditions to the welcoming site of home, Tenkata recognizes the people they're protecting are unique individuals whose lives extend beyond work. Supporting a world of evolving needs, Tenkata's innovations lead the way in user-centric design, technology, and sustainability around the globe. To learn more, please visit TenkataFabrics.com.
Welcome back to Main Street Firefighting, a podcast by Fire Engineering. My name is Lex Shady, and with me is my partner, Chris Tobin. As always, before we get started, we'd like to thank Fire Engineering for this opportunity, and you all for tuning in. Joining us tonight is Chief Dave LeBlanc from Harwich Fire Department in Harwich, Massachusetts. For those of you who don't know, Harwich is located on mid-Cape Cod. The Chief is a wealth of knowledge and allowed us to pick his brain on the firefighting culture of the Cape, what it means to have an aggressive truck culture in terms of overhaul, and the inherent hazards of Cape Cod construction, along with many other topics. We thoroughly enjoyed this conversation with the Chief and hope you do as well. Thanks again for coming on, Chief. We really appreciate you taking time out of your day to talk with us about building construction. Before we get started, can you tell us a little bit about your experience in the fire service and where you are today?
Sure. So I'm in Massachusetts. I started as a call firefighter in the town of Dennis. And before I was working full-time, I was a fireman that lived up the street. So I used to go to fires whenever they had them, and just got really interested as a young kid. Became a call firefighter there, went to the University of New Haven, got a degree in arson investigation from there, and came out and had some health issues with my heart, and wasn't able to go full-time as a firefighter. Had to give it up for a little bit. Was doing insurance investigations, trying to get into the arson thing. That didn't pan out, and I ended up dispatching, and I spent my first 8 years in Harwich as a dispatcher. And then when I was 29, I had surgery, and that resolved my heart issue. And I was able to, everything worked together. I had an awesome chief at the time who knew me from when I was a kid in Dennis. And one of my captain on my shift was retiring. And so we were gonna have a vacancy. And I said, listen, my doctors are willing to sign off on me doing this. And he's like, if they sign off on it, I have no problem. So I got hired in 2000 as a firefighter. And been there ever since. Never thought I'd be where I am now, sitting there as the chief of the department 22 years later, but weird how things like that happen. So but also grew up, Harwich is right next door to Dennis, so I grew up knowing all the guys in Harwich, very familiar with the town. So it's, you know, kind of a kind of like grew up where I belong, you know, type thing. And, mm-hmm. and great legacy, great history. That two towns always worked really well together. They're always super friendly, so it just was a good place to come back home to.
Can you tell us a little bit about like the culture and history of Harwich, leaning more towards like your response, manpower, maybe some of your guys' basic tactics for your first one fires?
Sure. So we're like every fire department in the world, short-staffed. We small fire. So Harwich is about 20 square miles. We have two fire stations, and our minimum shift strength is seven. So we have a captain and three at headquarters, a lieutenant and two at station two. So typical engine company is either three or four, depending, but we cross-staff the ambulance, we cross-staff the ladder. So headquarters has an engine ladder and an ambulance, station two has an engine and an ambulance. So we rely very heavily on off-duty response. Our guys, you know, back in the history was a call department with a few career guys, and that just morphed into more career, less call. And then Massachusetts was kind of funny. A huge liability issue came up in the 80s. With call firefighters not being protected by the pension system. So if they got hurt or killed, there was nothing for them. Actually, it got resolved later into the 90s by McNamara's law. A guy was killed up, I'm gonna forget the town, off just outside of Boston, one of the suburbs, was killed in the fire, was a call firefighter, and they had no protection for him. So they passed this law But Harwich saw the handwriting on the wall back in 88, and they dismantled the call department. So they went to fully staffed career department. At that time, we had a six-person shift. One was a dispatcher. So they, you know, again, still relying on the career staff coming back. So we've always kind of maintained almost that call department operational mindset. What you have to throw in there now is we run the ambulance. So ambulance for us, an ambulance trip is almost 2 hours. The hospital's 20 minutes away. So by the time you go out, get the patient, drive to the hospital, do the paperwork, get back, you know, you're 90 minutes plus out of town. So when the ambulance leaves, we hire somebody back to cover the station so the captain's not alone or so station two's not empty. But that can affect your manpower. So when I was captain, I could go from being on a two-man engine company to being on a four-man engine company in a matter of minutes. It just depended on, and that certainly impacts how we operate on a daily basis. But the Harwich has always had, and I'm going to use a word I hate to use because I think it gets overused, but an aggressive culture. You know, the town has always been, we're kind of in a good spot to go to fires. So we went to a lot of fires. We do a ton of mutual aid here. We're right currently on a first alarm from East Ham, all the way to Dennis. We move, something moves on a first alarm assignment. Town of Chatham, because we wrap Chatham completely, we actually send an engine and a truck on any reported fire in Chatham. As a matter of fact, Thanksgiving time, they had a bunch of medical calls going on, and the night before Thanksgiving, they had a fire. We were first due. Engine and truck first due to the fire. So so we get a lot of work because of that. And then, as you guys are familiar with the Cape, once you get out past Harwich and you turn the elbow, it's all the towns are single stacked. There's only one way in. So anything from Harwich beyond, we're moving anyways, if it's any. So, you know, Provincetown, which is a challenge, building stock wise, as we'll get into Cape buildings, they're all really close together. They're all wood frame and it's in the middle of the ocean. So it gets winds on a constant basis. We've gone to a couple of big fires up there, in the course of my career that, well, last one was when I was deputy. The one before that was, I was still dispatching, but, and then they had one prior to that where, you know, they burned down a significant part of the town and would have been a lot worse if there wasn't a great response. So
do you guys do a lot of mutual aid, or is it like automatic then for your fires?
Combination of both. Like any reported fire in Harwich, so the three towns that surround us, Brewster, Chatham, and Dennis, any reported fire in Harwich, they'll all send a company.
Okay.
So we get whatever we have staffed, plus whoever we recall off duty, plus three what we call line box companies or automatic response companies. And then everything beyond that's mutual aid. Everything beyond that, you know, we have a run card system. It's countywide. Everybody has their own run cards. We have a mutual aid center that manages that. And, you know, pretty much any confirmed fire for us is going to be a working fire, which will cover our stations and give us another engine and ambulance to the scene. So
it sounds like your guys are pretty invested in the department, but with the way things are changing lately, have you seen issues like getting the recalled staff coming in? Is that going down?
So, knock on wood, we still have a huge culture of people that come back, and we manage to cover the station a lot. Mm-hmm. The towns around us are not seeing that as much, and there's definitely a shift coming.
Mm-hmm.
The other issue they have right now, and I don't know what it's like where you guys are, but the housing market out here is insane. So we're seeing, my daughter sells real estate, we're seeing 1,300 square foot ranches sell for $600,000,
mm-hmm.
which is insane.
Right.
So what the problem is now, to be able to be eligible for callback, you have to live within 6 miles of either station.
Okay.
Nobody can afford to live in that area. So we're going to start hiring people that aren't eligible for callback, mm-hmm. because they can't move here. And I think we will gradually see a shift from people to people that want to come in, work their shifts, and then be off duty and not have to worry about coming back.
Sure. What kind of schedule do you guys work?
So we work a 42-hour work week. We do 24 on, 48 off, 24 on, 96 off.
Okay, cool.
Cool. So, yeah, this episode, you know, we are going to essentially frame it, pun intended, in the context of Cape Cod building instruction. This is a building instruction podcast. We always try to hit on a different facet of that subject matter. You know, we've talked to people from Boston about the triple deckers. You know, obviously we're in the Midwest when we talk a lot about brick buildings, but Cape Cod is a very unique subject in architecture because, if as you know, has essentially spawned its own layout. We're all familiar with the Cape Cod home or house.
Right.
Very common in the Midwest, and that just shows how popular it was at a certain time. But that's basically the majority of your building stock out there on a residential level and maybe a commercial level. I don't know. And that's kind of what we want to talk to you about is where we're basically going to the origin of that construction style and all the challenges that those Cape Cod homes and style bring to the table, because I'm sure we've all fought fire in them, and they get interesting very fast, and more so out in your neck of the woods, because the buildings are very old, or essentially right. The oldest on this continent.
Before we get too far on that, can you, for anyone that might be newer, describe what he's talking about when you talk about Cape Cod style buildings?
So when you look at a Cape Cod style building, the simple way in economics, almost like the taxpayer, I believe that they were spawned out of that. And we don't have a ton of old ones here, but so a Cape Cod building, when you look at it from the front, looks like a ranch.
Mm-hmm.
It's single story, but it's got a high pitched roof. And ultimately what it was it was designed for a future expansion or attic space dwelling under that gable. What's changed over time now is people dormered that gable off the back. So you were two full stories in the rear, still one story in the front with that big sloped roof. And then as times progress, like if you look at a modern cape, it's built looking like a dormer, but the reality is it's not a dormer. It's a full two stories in the rear frame that way. But what that gives you, and part of what you're talking about, and obviously the biggest concern, is it gives you knee walls in that front space.
Sure.
And the knee walls are always a problem in every fire, because you get that, you know, it's unchecked fire if you don't get in there quick, and you know it has a lot of implications for where we go and what we do next. So when you look at the older capes, they are a lot of them don't have dormers, or they only have a dormer in the middle where the bathroom would be. But the typical cape is laid out almost like a colonial on the first floor, window or two windows on either side, front door center, and your staircase is right behind the front door.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't have that two stories in the front.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I try to tell people, you know, in the when we're talking about legacy buildings and stuff like that, but specifically like framed buildings, or in the case of New England, I try to tell them when comparing to like the newer stuff, it's the same. It's like being in the same like video game, except the stuff out in New England has three or four extra levels into that video game, right? Like there's like, it's the same objective, the same goals. Yeah, you're in a house, but out there there's extra levels into their game. And you hear it all the time on your radio traffic. You can hear the challenges that you guys have to mess with that a department in Midwest suburbia or suburbia anywhere may not even know about, or it's just a different reality just because you have so much, I guess the variance in your building instruction out there is older. There's more voids, shake shingles. There's just a lot more avenue of extension for the fire to get. So all that makes the work harder, but it also makes you a better fireman, in my opinion.
So you also got to remember too, right, is that, you know, New England being thrifty Yankees, no building is ever the same size it was when it was first built. So everything is cobbled together and added onto. So you end up with these houses where, you know, you're going through room to room to get to the next room. And so the original footprint is nowhere near what it looks like.
Sure.
And I was just doing some research, just trying to figure out some ages of some of the common stuff that we go to, common buildings. And you look even on the assessor's plan, you know, you see the original footprint of the building, and then you see all these little these little boxes of these additions that, you know, hey, I need another bedroom. Okay, we're just going to frame it out. The last fire we had in town, the house was built on Nantucket.
Mm.
The guy's parents floated it across from Nantucket to the Cape.
That's crazy.
Moved it to this house, you know, where it is in Harwich. They moved the main house, and then they built off the back of it. So that's not uncommon. And that creates some weird, wonky void spaces where they butt the buildings together.
Sure.
And again, you know, like the knee walls is a concern for us. I don't know that we have it. I know we have balloon frame, typically in like our Greek revivals. because we have, you know, I'm running through and I sent you that picture.
Yeah.
I'm running through and I'm like, oh, that's what that house is. Yeah. Oh, that's, you know, so, but we have everything from early colonials to Dutch colonials to Greek revivals to Victorians. You know, we have them all. What the challenges we're dealing with now is a lot of them have been updated.
Mm-hmm.
So they're old stock, but inside they're new construction. So they're lightweight wood joists, and a bunch of other, you know, different challenges that come with that. So you might be going into a legacy looking building.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is it's it might as well have been built yesterday.
Sure. Yeah. And we've done a previous episode, you know, with Sean Donovan specifically talking about what they're facing in Boston with that, those full tear outs where they leave only the fronts, essentially.
Right.
Everything behind the front walls is brand new stuff. And we're starting to get a lot of that now in our neck of the woods, mm-hmm. you know, where they're taking out all the original floor joists, the fire cuts and all that kind of stuff, and then putting in joist hangers. So no longer is the joist going into a nice brick wall. It's just hanging there on your typical Lowe's joist hanger onto a ribbon board.
So, well, the other thing that happens a lot down here is, so we, everything's a tear down now. People are buying $1 million houses and tearing them down and building new. But for a while, to get through zoning and planning, one of the tricks to make it not a total teardown and need total review was they would leave one wall standing.
Yeah, yep.
So they would tear the entire house down, and you know, when you came back, it wouldn't look any, but that one wall would be original.
Yeah.
So, you know, we deal with a lot of that. And, you know, if there's a way for a builder to figure out a way to make it work, they're going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
The capes, like, it's really cool. If you look at the old capes, one of the things that they're really known for is that that course of shingles is really low to the ground.
Yeah.
You know, and there's also something called a cape and a half, which is a lot of them used to have a higher front wall, actually whole higher first floor.
Mm.
So it gave them more headroom in that attic space.
Mm. Okay.
So even without being dormered, if you think about it, like, it was almost like a 4-foot wall exterior.
Mm.
So that pushed the whole roof line up, and it gave, so when you looked at it, it was a really tall one-story building.
Okay.
But that's because they were trying to gain that extra attic space. But again, knee walls are a problem there. Not as much in those, because with that 4 foot,
mm-hmm.
and then the roof pitch, you were able to, now that almost became usable space. You could shove a bed on in there and everything else, and you didn't have the necessarily have the issues.
Sure. So do they not frame those out as often in with the knee walls then? Or it just kind of depends?
So I guess
it depends.
One side, I guess.
It depends. Yeah, and a lot of times you'll see the capes, so, you know, economically built as an unfinished second floor. So mm-hmm. you'll see, they'll build it, it'll look just like a ranch. When you come in, there'll just be another door right in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a typical ranch for us, you walk in the front door and you're at the basement stairs, or you're looking at the back of the basement stairs. You got to walk around to go down.
Mm-hmm.
So you're looking at that wall.
Mm-hmm.
On an unfinished cape, you walk in and there'll be a door there. You almost think it's a closet, but it's actually the door to the second floor.
Oh, okay.
Sure.
So they'll, you know, you build it as expanded, you know, unfinished space. So it's cheaper to get it built. And then down the road, you know, it gets finished off. What do you have with that is a lot of times it's finished off by the homeowner.
Mm-hmm.
So the construction of the second floor is not the construction of the first floor, both electrical, plumbing, all those things now aren't necessarily done by, like, you know, craftsmen, they're done by the homeowner. So
mm-hmm.
those are some of the challenges, like anything, of how, you know, what's the quality of the construction you're going in on a daily basis as
sure.
well.
So now, how has modern construction kind of like percolated its way? I mean, you know, that's the thing I noticed about the Cape is when I've been up there a couple times, it's obviously old. You can look around. I'm not running into the 1,000 home cookie cutter subdivisions. I don't know if that's, I think that's part of the Cape culture. They want it to look old. It looks amazing. But the stuff that does make it through, is it more like just single home builders, or are the subdivisions coming in, or are they keeping that stuff zoned to another part?
So it depends on where you are. So, like, you know, if you, like, any community is built, like Harwich was originally built, there were two main streets, Route 28 and Main Street, and Bank Street ran kind of between the two villages.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and everything was a cart path, and everything's named off where the road went. So the main road in Harwich that goes east is Orleans Road, because mm-hmm. it was the road to Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the original houses were big houses built on, you know, right on the main roads. And then, as you know, in the 60s and 70s, they started doing the subdivisions where there were big chunks of land that were developed. And those are more cookie cutter developments, a lot of ranches in those,
mm-hmm.
more so ranches than capes.
Okay.
And, you know, that's like maybe late 70s, early 80s, around there. We have one that's probably a couple hundred houses. just north of the highway. We have another one off in East Harwich that's probably, you know, maybe 60 or 70 houses. And they're a mixture of Capes. And that's what they do. They have a little bit more flair where it's not cookie cutter, same house, mm-hmm. up, flip it, same house, you know, type thing. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's 100 ranches and 30 Capes make up the subdivision. And then some mixture of once people have bought them and added on to them and made their changes. We also have a little bit of government housing. The Coast Guard base in Chatham had right. Coast Guard housing in here. So those are ranches, mm-hmm. but they're really low pitch truss roof ranches. They were literally, you know, slapped up. And so we have a whole neighborhood that's all those. And those have all been changed over the years. So it's just, you know, it's a matter of your, I think like any community, you know, I can drive down any street and find just about any type of construction. And it's, you know, it's funny, you know, some of it's, a lot of it is post and beam mm-hmm. instead of, so what I would look at and I'd be like, house, my brain's thinking balloon frame because mm-hmm. of the era of the house, but sure. it's actually post and beam.
Yeah.
So yeah, you get big void spaces behind the wall, but they don't go vertically. You okay. know, they might be run horizontally a little bit, but you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, we catch ourselves all the time thinking that old stuff in the Midwest is balloon frame, and it just isn't the case. Everything has a platform yeah. frame.
Right.
I mean, I'm talking even the houses that we know are built turn of the century, stone foundation, log windows, all the above. We get behind the walls and no, it's definitely not yeah. balloon frame. But we just, a good rule of thumb is just to, you know, give it the benefit of the doubt that it right. is. So
right.
Now, obviously you get hurricanes and storms, not often, but enough in that part
yeah.
of the country. Now, has there been an era to where, say, you got a very large storm that swiped off a good portion of your building stock in post? Now, has it been different buildings, or is it basically, there was no big?
No, about the only thing that changed with us with the storms is as the building code has been changed to, you know, within a mile of the water, you got to do certain things. So, you know, hurricane windows were a thing, ties. Mm-hmm. I mean, whoever in the government is related to the guy that's building the ties is, you know, they're making a fortune because the amount of steel that's in my house that I built now, my house was built in 2015. It's crazy from my first house that I built, which would have been back in 93, 94 to this house, the amount of anchors and straps and steel that's in it is crazy. But it's, you know, the idea is it's really not necessarily to protect your house, but it's to keep your house from taking out the other houses.
Yeah. Right.
You know, so they want the windows to fail because you get the pressure gradient, the windows fail, then the wind blows in, then it blows the roof off because it overpressures the house. So everything's tied down to the foundation, strapped, tied. There's, you know, all kinds of anchor straps and everything else. So we've seen a lot of that and, you know, the hurricane windows and the variant or the way around the hurricane windows is if you build, if you have covers, mm-hmm. and I don't know, I'm not familiar enough with the code right now, but there was a while where you could build your house within a mile of the water. Okay. And as long as you were able to protect your windows, you didn't have to do hurricane glass. So you just had to build plywood covers for them or whatever. I don't know what the code is now.
Gotcha.
But, so that's probably the biggest change we see. We have, knock on wood, in my lifetime, well, we've had a ton of storm damage. We've lost like swaths of houses. It's not like a tornado went through. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've had tree damage, wires down, poles down, and damage to houses, but not enough that we would, you know, they would have to rebuild the whole neighborhood kind of thing.
That's good.
So you talked a little bit earlier about how you have some of your older buildings kind of being gutted where they will keep like one wall or whatever. When you yeah. roll up on these for fires or alarms, are those pretty easy to identify, or have you guys found yourself being tricked by them?
No, it's hard. It's hard because, you know, how do you tell the difference between a newly painted house, you know, old stock house mm-hmm. or a completely renovated old stock house? So, you know, getting out in the community and being aware of what's going on. I mean, I drive around around town all the time. My fire inspector, who used to be a builder, or has a builder background, he's out all the time, and we're constantly talking about what's new, what we've seen, what's different, you know, all that's going on in this house. We had a house right now, really interesting. They're building, so it's a hemp house. Hmm. So they actually bought, the guy that's building the house bought the owner, not mm-hmm. the contractor, this pump that they have, and it's a mixture of calcium chloride, lime, and hemp, and they blow it into the stud base. Mm-hmm. It ends up on the exterior almost being like a stucco house. Mm-hmm. And the inside, it's finished off with lath, but it's bamboo lath, not plaster, or not pine lath.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to shingle over the exterior of the house so that it fits the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at, and you look up hemp houses, it's really popular in Europe, France,
yeah,
does it. And it's those Tudor style or those stucco exterior finishes. Sure. That's what it is.
That's cool.
But when you're looking at the walls are, you know, the walls are this thick.
Sure.
It's crazy. And
yeah,
it's, you know, it's super tight, and it's all those things, which are all challenges for us when we're fighting fires, because houses are so tight,
mm-hmm,
and the energy code is driving that. But this, you know, so there's always like a new wrinkle that's coming in, one that we're not,
sure,
you know, not used to seeing. And that one, you know, I did a bunch of videos and went down and talked to the guy. The contractor was super nice. But
yeah, that's something that's starting to pick up steam, that form of construction. Now, I can't remember the specific term for that. There is a word for it, but I can't think of it on top of my head. But yeah, that's starting to probably, we're starting to get that, and we're starting to get the Connex box container buildings. That's starting to work itself into some large actual commercial type, like restaurants and stuff are starting to have them.
Really?
But, very interesting. So yeah, we've had a yurt pop up recently.
So we don't have them residential, but like in Nickerson State Park, there's yurts you can rent, you know, people that'll go camping in a yurt.
It was funny. the same kind of construction you're talking about with like the mud filled walls and stuff like that.
But, really? Yeah. So that's strange. You know, and we have, so like one of the things, our building code is really kind of restricted. So we're currently at acre zoning. So you can't build on, you know, less than 40,000 square feet, mm-hmm, unless it's pre-existing.
Mm.
Some areas we have this area, it's a DCPC, it's District of Critical Planning and Concern, where it's acre and a half zoning. So that, you know, just to push the houses farther out. So that's means less housing stock,
mm-hmm,
bigger spaces, takes away our, you know, our exposure problems and those concerns. But we have a neighborhood, and Chris, I've sent you videos of it. We call it the campgrounds, and it's this little neighborhood of really old, tiny cottages that have just been built and built and built. And they're literally a car apart. There's a driveway between. And that is like one of my fire inspector and I talked about this one. And that's one of ours. It's going to be a car fire between them, or they're all adding patios with fire pits.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to, with a little bit of wind, it's right on the water,
sure,
with a little bit of wind.
Yeah.
We're going to have a really, you know, bad time with it. And it's all old housing stock and new old housing stock.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lot of those one wall buildings are down there where they tore the thing and gutted it. So you've no idea what we're going to find when we get in there. And, you know, we're going to make a defensive push from Route 28 to get down there, because it's just,
right,
it's a big neighborhood. There's a lot of houses in a really small spot.
Yeah.
The roads are one car width wide.
Sure.
So you don't have any fire break there. You know, it's going to be a problem.
And that was the thing I noticed up in, you know, Provincetown, is just a tiny little, it's not a grid, you know, it's a little windy, small street. I don't know what it is curb to curb, but the buildings almost turn with the contour of the road. And I can understand how a fire there would just be catastrophic on a bad windy day if the wind wasn't favorable. So
yeah, it's and I'll send you this. I can't remember the name of it. I think it's called "It Happened That Night," and it's the last fire that they had in Provincetown was the Whaler's Wharf fire. Whaler's Wharf is right on Commercial Street. The Crown and Anchor is next to it, which was a 3 or 4 story wood frame hotel.
Mm.
Crown and Anchor was the Whaler's Wharf was it was like a bunch of gift shops and everything else, but it was masonry construction. And so it got those two buildings and went left and right, candy shop next door to it. There was almost no wind that night. Had there been wind, because it's right on the water, right on McMillan Wharf, it's right, it would have been a completely different fire. The fact that it was on the water probably saved, because you only had exposures on one side.
Oh, sure.
But if the wind had been coming in out the water, and our prevailing wind, summertime is southwest,
mm-hmm,
wintertime is northeast.
Okay.
So northeast wouldn't have been a problem. Summertime, it would have been a completely different story.
Sure. Yeah. People don't realize this. I didn't realize it too when I was up there seeing the brush fires or wildland fires with the fire towers. You know, you don't think of Cape Cod in that aspect, but yeah, I mean, it's just, you got the forests for it.
There's still big chunks of you know, Nickerson State Park. Mm-hmm. You know, everything up around the military bases. You know, there's thousands and thousands of acres up there. And, you know, we have, even in Harwich, we have a state park called Hoxton State Park, which is, I don't know how big it is, but that's in that DCPC I was talking about. That's mm-hmm. there. There's some houses that are in there. There's some state forests that's in there. So it's a mix. So that, you know, for us, we're going to have an area where you could have a brush fire that extends to houses and have a pretty significant fire that, you know, because they're old big trees and everything else, because it's protected.
Sure. So now how does the older buildings, how does that manifest itself into your fire culture? I mean, the easy answer most expectedly would be probably y'all have more of an aggressive side of truck work and or that kind of stuff. Or basically you guys understand where the fire is going, I would say more than most, because that's by necessity, right?
Right. So it's weird. Definitely. Like I was thinking about that when I was looking at that question. I'm like, and it's actually what I wrote down is, our foundation of fire attack is built on truck work. So we actually, I would almost say, you know, we overhaul backwards, right? So, mm-hmm. you know, line selection and line placement, obviously that's part of it, but we're always looking at like, where's the fire? Where is it? And where's it going? Mm-hmm. And those things have kind of been a holdover. The big problem, and we talked about this earlier, is tool selection, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, yeah, any tool will open a wall, but if you go into a plaster and lath house versus a sheetrock house, you know, the plaster rake's going to work much better than a Boston rake for you know, or plaster hook for sheetrock.
Sure.
Now, there's ways around that, and we, you know, we get around it, but the... Just Lex, the other thing you mentioned about the new construction, one of the things that we've had a couple of, so we had a fire back in 98, 99. It was actually one of the first Maydays that I was involved in before I was on as a firefighter. And it was a new construction house, platform construction, forced hot air heating system. Fire was in the kitchen, started in the kitchen cabinets, burned down, and they used the joist bays as the cold air return plenum. Mm-hmm. So the fire got in that and ran the plenum and actually burned like a balloon frame house. Mm-hmm. So we were chasing fire all different levels and in all different areas from mm-hmm. where the origin was. And the Mayday was, it burned the floor out in that kitchen around the cabinets. Mm-hmm. The officer that was on the line went looking for the fire. The line went left, he went, line went right, he went left, and he fell into the kitchen. Mm-hmm. He was able to self-extricate. It wasn't, you know, ended up not being a big deal, but so that was 98, 99. A month ago I went to a fire in Eastham and it was the exact same scenario. Basement fire. We get in, we start knocking out the basement. I shot up to the first floor. We had fire extended up in the first floor. Got a line in on that. I shot up to the second floor and we had fire coming out of all the heat returns on the second floor. So one of the things we're seeing is these forced hot air systems, and I don't know if anybody else has seen it or not. If there's not dampers in them, they, you know, they become a path of transit mm-hmm. floor to floor, and you could go through areas that there's fire transiting that area, and you would never know that there was, you know, the wall's perfectly fine, but you got fire above you and fire below you, and so that's one of the challenges we're dealing with some of the new construction too. We have a lot of forced hot air because of air conditioning, you know.
Mm, yeah, good point.
So with the younger generations coming into the fire service, how do you guys go about training them with this, you know, truck work centered department? I know that's typically a skill that, you know, the more experienced people do. So how do you guys go about working that in with your younger members?
So we do a lot. We try and do, and the captain's good about it. Buildings under construction, they'll do a lot of walkthroughs and take them through. Even buildings that aren't under construction, you know, we have some old timber frame cranberry houses and stuff. That, you know, we'll do some walkthroughs and give them the exposure to what the buildings are and try and pass on the lessons verbally. And then whenever we get the opportunity, we get a house handed to us, we will tear it apart if given the opportunity. And do the last house we got was an old, probably 1800s residence. It was a parish house for the church. We used it for 2 days, smoked it and used it for flowing water and search and everything else, and then went in there and pulled ceilings, and it was plaster and lath, so it was great for that. Cut holes in the roof, did a whole bunch of stuff that gave them experience and some ideas on what to do. And then, unfortunately, the rest of it is on the job. You know, every fire is a training fire. You know, where you're pulling the young guys aside and trying to show them, hey, this is a great way. You got a Boston rake. This is a great way to go after sheetrock. So you're not pulling down little 6-inch pieces for the rest of the afternoon. Okay. You know, make some punches and pull it down. You know, pull down a sheet. Stuff like that. So, mm-hmm. And I think like everybody else, you do what you make every opportunity you can to make it a lesson and try and get them in the buildings. Use every opportunity you can to see what you're dealing with and realize it's going to look different when it's on fire.
So now when it comes to these Cape Cods with the knee walls, that's the main challenge everyone knows. But what's your go-to, I guess, strategy with that? I mean, is it a simultaneous? There's always a crew going to the roof whenever they get there, and you're gonna wait for that to get opened before y'all start getting to this, or you're just gonna get where you can get, or are you gonna try to get it from below?
Yeah, I think it's a little combination of both. I mean, it'll dictate. You know, the roof for us is not always a guarantee right away because of how we operate. So we're gonna get a line in place, but we're gonna check the knee walls early. You know, the good thing about the knee walls is usually it's just sheetrock, unless it's older, but you know, you can punch a hole into it. And the first fire that I had the nozzle on is in the neighborhood I live in now, which is kind of ironic. And we were working, came in at 2 o'clock in the morning. They had a fire in a fireplace. It burned out of the firebox, up into the wall, and shot across the ceiling. It was a weird house. It was like a cape, but the stairway was actually in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. So it was just an attic stairway in the kitchen. So we stretch, we get up into the attic, and the attic is clear as a bell. Yep. No, the house is on fire. The attic's clear as a bell. So we crawl to the gable end, mm-hmm. and underneath the window, basically right above the fireplace, there's some fire burning up through the floor. We punch its particle board. We punch it down real quick, make a hole, and we wet it down, fire up. Me and the officer were looking at each other like, oh, that was easy. So he calls out to the chief, and he says, fire's knocked down on the second floor. And he's like, I got heavy fire blowing through the roof on the on the front side of the building. Mm. And it was knee walls.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And I turned around and I punched a hole through the sheetrock that was right next to me, and the entire attic space went to zero visibility, and then fire came rolling right out. And that whole knee wall space was just filled with fire. But we had no temperature difference, no smoke, no nothing. It was just all contained in that space. So I think that, you know, we're aware of them and we try and get them open as quick as we can to see what they are. And the problem now with a lot of new construction is air conditioning units get shoved in knee wall spaces. A lot of times they use them for storage. They build dressers mm-hmm. into the knee wall spaces because it's a great use of dead space. So they're not always just like an empty void space anymore. Now they have stuff in them, mm-hmm. and that makes it more of a challenge. Number one, it makes a place where fire can start because of the HVAC and everything else. But the other one, you know, how do you open a knee wall space when it's a dresser?
Sure.
You know, it's not just as simple as punching a hole in the wall.
Sure. We've been caught by some knee wall stuff just because it's in the back behind a closet. So people, you know, they basically have a thermal imager in their hand or whatever, and they forget to get to the back of the closet to check that wall, as right. opposed to just, you know, maybe opening the door. It's when they're set back in or they're framed out in front of, like you're talking about. Yeah, right. That's just a whole nother.
Yeah, you might not even recognize it. If they take the whole space to make, you know, to square the room off so you don't have the low angle mm-hmm. that you would have, so you just have flat ceiling and everything else, you have knee walls, and it's a hidden knee wall, so you don't even really kind of know that space is there.
To go to your point, though, I mean, the story you told is the same story you hear over and over and over again from people that have had issues. You talk to anyone who's had a bailout of a half story or something like that, they all say the same stuff. It was clear, a hole was made, it got hot and unclear very fast, we had to leave. And then they usually can't find the stairs or some sort of that combination of events. So then the question is, when you have a confirmed knee wall fire, you have water, do you then... Hopefully you have a pike pole. Maybe you don't have a pike pole. It's just you and the nozzle. Now what's the play? You know, knowing what's going to happen as soon as you open the wall up, you know, maybe do you jam the nozzle up into the wall? Some people say to do that. There are obvious special nozzles for that. Not widely used, not necessarily dependably tested in the field.
Right.
Or you know, maybe call for a pike pole. Maybe if it's a half story, maybe the officer grabs some sort of tool to where at least you know what's going to happen. But at least you have water, and you're not caught off guard by it.
And so, you know, that's what happened. If we had a couple more bodies, it wouldn't have been a big deal. I made the hole in the wall. Fire came out. I had the nozzle. I just picked the nozzle up. And, you know, the nice thing about it was a wide open knee wall space, so it mm-hmm. ran the whole front of the house. Mm-hmm. So once we accessed it, you know, we put the whole fire out in 2 seconds. You know, it wasn't a big deal. Just a little bit of, you know, holy shit for a moment.
Sure, but, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan. I was always a big fan when I was an officer, even when I was on, you know, we were stretching a line, of having a tool, because it's a force multiplier. Having mm-hmm. a tool, even if it's just a small halogen, something, just gives you the ability to open, check for extension, do all kinds of things. So yeah, I think you got to be ready for it. You got to know you're going to make that hole. You got to know that the potential of it going really bad, really quick is there. Mm-hmm. And just be ready for it, to have somebody on the nozzle ready to flow water. So the second you open that, you know, you're making an impact on it and you don't get caught by surprise.
Yeah. I know the people that was like, we've had the same problem with half stories in our department, and there was an individual who did kind of a case study on it, and half stories were the most injurious fires for St. Louis. And they did a whole class called Killer in the Attic based off that. But I you know, reached out and talked to some individuals who had that situation occur to them. And basically the things that they learned from that was, you know, at the top of the stairs, and we talked about this, how, you know, where overhaul essentially is putting out the fire.
Right.
You know, you basically do all your work from the top of the stairs. You're opening up, someone with a pipe pull's coming from behind the hand line. You know, basically this nozzleman officer, then there's someone with a hook or something. Essentially, you're in tandem. It's overhaul is literally putting the fire out at that point, right? So,
right.
And then, you know, all goes well in the perfect world, there would be a hole in the roof. And then that would be, you know, remedying some of that condition. But then here's the thing is, so you give someone a pipe pole and they instinctively are going to go towards the ceiling. Mm-hmm. Now we all know that that's only a third of the knee wall problem, right? So
right.
where they maybe should go first is to the sides, because you can pull that all day, but that's only going to be the tail of the problem.
And I think the other thing is if you go to the sides, you're going to get the base of the fire versus mm-hmm. pulling the ceiling.
Sure.
Great, you know, you get that fire down, but meanwhile, it's still burning at your level.
Right.
And at some point, that's going to change.
Sure.
That's going to either breach that sheetrock. And, you know, that, like I said, that fire, you know, it's still, like, clear as day, remember it. There was zero temperature.
Yeah.
That sheetrock was holding all that heat back. There was zero temperature in that room. And that entire knee wall space, 24-foot long house, was filled with fire.
Yeah, no, I mean, we've all been, like, those of us who know, right? Like, we've all been in there.
People forget how much heat that sheetrock can hold, too. Like, it...
Yes, it's what it's designed to do, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's the thing, that's a big challenge with these knee wall fires and these half stories, and you know, that's the bread and butter, the Cape Cod, you know, building is trying to pull the right wall, the right time, and then expecting the outcome of that. But then a lot of people forget that when it's low like that, that's where the floor joists are tied into that wall. Think about what that's doing, right? So, I mean, and we've all seen it. How many times have we seen the floor joists burnt out behind the knee wall, right? Like, totally. And so that's another thing, too, is people want to get behind the knee wall. And then I've seen a couple people go back down to the first floor pretty quick. You know, I've almost done it myself. So all stuff you don't know until, you know, you learn it the hard way. So,
you know what's funny, too, is the gambrel roof.
Yep.
You know, the gambrel. So a lot of times it's Dutch, they call them Dutch colonials, and they have dormers on them.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times they don't. They just have a window cut into that.
Sure.
And that's basically an 8-foot or a 7-foot tall knee wall.
Right. Mm-hmm. And
right? You can literally, to your point, you can literally walk into that space.
Sure.
It's narrow, you know, and you know, the roof is like this, but that's, you know, and that, but there's another building where you might not be thinking knee wall, mm-hmm. but it, you know, that's what it is. It's all
right. That's the one. So the gambrel, we have quite a few of them. Ours are usually it's usually a brick first floor with a gambrel second floor. That's the one exception to the half story rule, right? It's a full length story, but it is a half story construction mm-hmm. building with knee walls. And that's why we still size it up as a half story. And we, like you said, the overhaul, it gets in the layers and it's just a nightmare with the shingling on the outside of it. So a lot of exterior ladder work.
So the other thing we're seeing a lot of, you know, the spray foam with for insulation. So we had a fire last week in the next town over, and it actually started in the ceiling of the basement. So when we got in, the first floor looked like the Grand Canyon. There was like this 30-foot long trench that had burned. And the only thing that I think, and I'm not 100% sure, and I haven't talked to find out, but looked like it followed, again, the heating system,
mm-hmm.
and it burned in that main line. But it burned, there were two bedrooms off one wing. It burned up through the walls in there, got into the attic space above. The middle of the house was cathedral all the way up. So it was a story and a half, but it was cathedral all the way to the top. It was all glass. And then there were like wings off it. One wing was the kitchen, one wing was these two bedrooms. But the foam burned, like, so we went, my deputy was in the first floor, and, you know, I stuck my head in and I'm like, you need to get in this bedroom, because I got like structural brown smoke under pressure coming out of this bedroom window. Mm-hmm. And I backed out and I looked and it went from like that structural brown to like a browny, greeny, I don't even know what color. It was weird. And the only thing we could figure, it was all the spray foam. But this house was tight. Okay. It was hot. We had a ton of heat on the first floor. Not a lot of fire in the basement. Hmm. Not even a lot of fire in the first floor. But it just burned and it was tight. And it was all glass. Hmm. And it's one of the first fires in a long time where I was, like, I was telling people not to vent.
Sure.
I was, yeah. I was like very calculated, like, okay, they're past this window. You can now vent those windows. So mm-hmm. then we're getting rid of some of that, but it's not going to, you're not going to draw it to them. You're not sure. going right. to, it was weird. It was a weird fire,
yeah.
but
yeah, those,
we had a lightning strike, same thing, hit the valley of a roof. Mm-hmm. So we knew we had fire above the ceiling. Mm-hmm. We're pulling the ceilings down and it's all spray foam. Mm-hmm. And we're like, where's the fire? And then you poke through the spray foam and the fire was burning between the roof sheathing and the spray foam on the underside of the roof sheathing.
Yeah, and that's always a question we get from people in classes is how much space can fire fit there, kind of thing. And I'm like, if there can be air, there can be fire, you know. Right. I mean, people don't even realize between two bys, right? Like, yeah. Between two boards, that's right. All it takes. And
that spray foam, because it'll melt and burn.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. It'll create its space, so it's actually giving it fuel, so it'll burn in that space, and that's what happened in that fire. And that was weird. I mean, it was a bathroom. It was it actually wasn't sheetrock. It was Tunga Group pine ceilings.
Oh man, that's bad.
So Tunga Group pine ceilings with spray foam insulation, and the fire was on the other side of the spray foam. So it was, yeah, it's you know, a lot of, and this is new construction. This is what we're dealing with, you know, with everything. And we're seeing that in all of these, and back, you know, Lex, to keep it on point, in houses that look like they're, you know, 200 years old, 300 years old, you know, it's crazy.
Gotcha. All right, next.
So as you've gone through your fire service career, has there ever been a building that caught you by surprise? We've kind of talked a little bit about that now, but hindsight being what it is there something that you can say now that you realize you missed that would have clued you into it?
I think probably, you know, that knee wall story is probably the best story of that. I've never been like a super student of building construction. I've always been aware of it. My college class, I went to class in, you know, in college in the late 80s, and my building construction in school was, it might have been Brannigan's book. It was slow and painstakingly boring, and there was no relation to, I think anytime you can relate it to what we actually do versus talking about the, you know, the features of buildings, when you start talking about them as we're talking about them and how it impacts what we do is a little bit different. I didn't get that experience out of it in college. And that's not a slam on my professors or anything else like that. It's just, it wasn't, I remember being like, this is a course I have to take. And then I never picked up another building construction book for a long time.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's the way a lot of college programs still are. If you take a building construction class, it's more architecture based than fireman.
That was my class. Yeah. It was a terrible, terrible time. Yeah.
I learned, you know, my wife and I built seven of our own houses, general contracted and whatever. So I learned a lot about construction from doing that, and probably a lot of my building knowledge comes from that. Mm-hmm. And then having conversations, my brother-in-law is a contractor, so he and I talk all the time now. You know, my brain's in a different space than it was you know, then. And I think that's, you know, how do you keep it relevant for those new guys? But, you know, if I could do my whole career over again, I don't know that I would, but if I could, I would definitely be way more of a student of, you know, it's our battle space, you know, to steal from everybody else has said, it's where we're going to do our work, and we're going to do it at a huge disadvantage because it's going to be hot and it's going to be zero visibility. And the building isn't going to be, I think that's the other thing, Lex, is the building's never going to be how it was built.
Right.
That's probably one takeaway I have, that, you know, okay, I'm going into this ranch that, you know, they finished the attic off, even though it's not even a half story, you know, or they've done something. We had one house, one story house, peaked roof, one story house, and had an attic scuttle in the hallway. And I was in there on a medical call, and all of a sudden I saw something move out of the corner of my eye, and I looked up and there was a kid in the attic. And like, kid waving at me, and I'm waving at the kid and everything else. And I realized that they were using that attic space for a bedroom for the kids.
Oh, it's, okay.
Yeah.
There was a ladder on the wall. There would be no indication at all that it was occupied space.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that that's the one thing is I, you know, try to go in always expecting the unexpected, that it's not going to be what I think it is or what it looks like from the street.
Right.
And just because every ranch looks like doesn't mean they're going to be the same. Just because every cape looks like doesn't mean they're going to be the same, because people change things.
Sure.
And that has a profound impact on what we do. And if I expect it to be one way and it's not, then my mind is going to get screwed up and then I'm not going to perform well.
And so that goes to two points that I always try to make is, you know, that's a saying, every fire is, you know, the same. And I'm like, man, that is a terrible way to, you're right. Yes. Every flame is the same, physically speaking. But as soon as you wrap that with a building, or even worse, put it in a void space inside a building. I mean, look, we're talking to you right now, who literally has grown up in the same spot they have fought fire in an entire career, with a building stock that the place you are in founded, and yet you have all these experiences with variants. Right. Like, that should prove to everyone that all bets are off behind the door. You can make some educated guesses from the street, but beyond that, like, there's so many unknowns, you know?
So how many times have you heard, right, you can tell a balloon frame building because the windows are lined up over the top of each other, right? I've heard that since the beginning of my career.
Yeah.
And I have called every building that I've ever been in balloon frame because of that. And and they're not.
No, you know, they're so not.
I think they're way more rare than people think.
Way more rare. Yeah.
I just don't think there's that many of them left anymore. So I mean, there's nothing wrong with assuming it is, but you're right. Like, it the standard doesn't fit.
And that's an awesome point there, too. You know, I mean, that just doesn't it's – And like I said,
there's a lot of bad generalizations that are out there based on, you know, certain things. You know, the other thing that we run into a lot with these ranches is, you know, like everybody used to want living space. So they convert the garages into living space. Mm-hmm. And I've seen it convert into bedrooms. I've seen it convert into living rooms. You know, the old days when I was growing up, they used to just put a screen door across the garage and it would be like a porch.
Sure. Yep.
But now it's full blown. It's a full blown living space. So we had a house in Dennis. We had a fire. This was kind of cool. Front door was a garage door. Went around the back of the house, sliders, opened the sliders. It was a living room. Up until the first 5 feet of the garage, behind that garage door. So they kept the garage door, and they used it as like a shed. And there was a door into that living space out of that little shed area. So looks like it's a garage. It's not a garage. It was actually living space. Mm-hmm. So if you went into it from the house thinking you were coming out the garage door, you weren't coming out the garage door.
Friggin' bedroom.
And we had another one. This was in Howard, which wasn't on fire, but same thing, converted the garage into a living room. The last 5 feet, the back 5 feet of it, there were a set of double doors, open like almost French doors, but they were solid. And it was a storage space, and that's where the oil tank was for the house.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. So, like, and, you know, we're not architects. We're not engineers. We're not even architect or engineer students. All we are is people who are interested in building construction that happen to have a growing library on the matter. But the point is we're constantly learning stuff on a weekly basis. And we really notice how much we don't know when we do these walkthroughs on these main streets. We get so many questions. My answer is just, I don't know. I have no idea what the heck that is, what that means, why that's like that. Maybe that's the only place in America that exists right now, because people do crazy things in these buildings, and it might not be in a book. They're not, but that might not be a word. There might not be a term for that. You know, like you said, the older these buildings are, the weirder they get, you know, and so.
And I think what happens too, right, is as people move across the country, they bring
With them, the things, right?
Mm-hmm. So weird thing that happened in New England 300 years ago, all of a sudden ends up in Main Street, St. Louis, because some guy moved there from there.
I've brought that up so many times in classes, specifically with Sean's building in Boston, where they had the brick firewall inside the wood frame building that was built by like the British or something. It was something crazy.
Yep.
I'm like, what's saying that same architect or engineer didn't move to Chicago or St. Louis 200 years ago and do the same thing in what then was a farm, but is now just an old farmhouse in the neighborhood, right? Like, that stuff's still there. So, I mean, people forget about that, you know?
So the fire, I think I told you about it. I sent you some pictures of that, the trust fire we had. It was a commercial space, peaked roof commercial, burned up in the back storeroom, got in the attic, burned across. And the trusses, it was really interesting because they had sheathed it, and the sheathing jointed on the seam of the trusses where the gusset plates were on the top cord. So when the gusset plates failed, the sheet, you know, everything buckled down.
Mm-hmm.
We were operating on the assumption there was a firewall in this building because the fire burned over and we could see, you know, a blocking.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't a true firewall. It didn't pierce the roof.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Come to find out, it wasn't a firewall at all. It was just OSB that was built over the cords or framed over the cords
okay.
of the trusses. And it was like if this was the wall of the stores,
mm-hmm.
the wall was here. So there was nothing to prevent it. So it was just another weird thing that somebody did. You know, some builder was probably like, oh, I'm going to use this to stiffen it up or something.
Yeah, right. Sure.
Like, I guess 10 sheets of OSB I got to get rid of, or, you know, whatever.
just hang them up there, yeah.
Yeah, so it just happened. We have, you know, weird things. Our main street, Route 28, Harwichport, is a liquor store.
Mm-hmm.
And you stand in front of the beer coolers and liquor store, there's a pull-down stairway. If you pull down the stairs, there is a completely framed house on the second floor. Kitchen, living, like I've gone up in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still got wallpaper. The kitchen cabinets are still there and everything else. There's no exterior windows on the second floor part of the liquor store.
That's crazy.
And it's just, you know, there's just a space up there. So you have absolutely no idea what you're going to find.
Right.
And I think to me, that's the biggest thing, right?
Members wouldn't know if you guys didn't pass it down, right? Like, I mean, they would have no idea.
And
right.
So that's
and
why.
Until just now, I just forgot about it.
Yeah, and that's the cool thing about when we get out into the street, when we do these classes and start talking, that's the you know, the old members get to chime in on that stuff because they forget too. They're not just, but it strikes their memory when they're walking by the building. Like, oh yeah, by the way, you'd never believe what's in the basement of this place. Where, you know, or hey, there's a hidden tunnel from here to there. Like, all crazy stuff that you would never think about talking about until you're walking by it. And
so you just jogged my memory on another one. So we have a neighborhood in West Harwich. They tore it down, built a house. There's a full basketball court in the basement.
Oh,
so you go across the basement floor and then it goes deeper and there's a basketball court built. So the, you know, 10-foot walls aren't uncommon around here anymore. They got to build a thicker foundation wall, but they want to maximize that basement space as living space. But there's a basketball court in the basement, and it's, so if you're in the basement, crawling across the basement floor, you're going to come to a point where you're going to drop another 4 feet into this basketball court.
that would be weird. Yeah, I mean,
exactly. Who would expect that?
Yeah, no.
You know? Yeah, I mean, basements in them. I mean, right. Pools, bowling alleys. You know, I mean, you got home theaters. You got crazy stuff in basements, and that's a whole other thing too. That you guys are a coastal department, but still have basements. That's kind of rare, right? Yeah. So,
I don't know how rare it is. I mean, you know, I always grew up with that. I mean, everything around slab construction around here is unusual.
Yeah, well, I mean, from a national standpoint, I grew up in Florida.
Yeah.
You dig 3 feet and you're in mud, right? So, I mean, it's not happening. But that's something that I would think about since y'all are on a massive peninsula up there. Y'all would have basements, but I guess the geography allows it. So just one more challenge into the scheme of things.
Right. Yep.
So.
So kind of talking a little bit about training, how does your department do it? Do you guys don't have your own academy, correct? You hire
trained
members?
Use the state academy. I was going to call one of the last guy that went through and see. I know they cover building construction. It's, you know, they train them to 1,002, the standard. Mm-hmm. It's 10 weeks long through the state. They do a great job, but I don't know how much building construction is. And because it's a state academy,
mm-hmm.
it's going to be more vanilla than more local. So really, you know, whatever they get, they're going to get from us.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have like necessarily a formal building construction or, you know, training program, so to speak, but we have a pretty good culture of making sure that our people are aware of our community. You know, we do our posted buildings. My fire inspector is really good about going around and identifying those.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, those are all our old buildings. And, you know, yes, believe it or not, there are people living in those buildings. Just because it's Cape Cod doesn't mean we don't have those same problems. And
so you do. You bring another point. Not to get sucked down the rabbit hole of you know, occupancy. But y'all have a seasonal population. You know, come August, it's exponentially hot, right. So there is that too. You know, I mean, when it comes in the, has that house been sitting there? You know, no one's taking care of it. Through you know, half the year, and then all of a sudden now there's strangers in it, Airbnbs, you have all that to think about, you know?
Right.
So
and they are. So Airbnbs are obviously, like with this housing crunch, with this whole thing, Airbnbs are out of the, you know, they've always been a thing, They're huge now. My neighborhood alone, there's six of them.
Right.
I mean, I moved in here, there might have been one.
They're starting to pass. They're starting to pass ordinances now to where they're limiting them because they're literally taking over the towns here, and the town doesn't want that. You know, they want homeowners to an extent.
And we're having the same problem. And there's very little restriction. You know, they're supposed to register with the health department and everything else. And I don't know how many are actually following the rules, but. So you have people that are in a house that they're unfamiliar with, you know, which is rental population, which the Cape's always had. And then, you know, to your point, we have a lot of we probably grow, I'm trying to remember. So the town is, we're about 13,000 year round. That changed with COVID. We probably bumped closer to 15. I would say summertime estimates that were usually like between 35 and 40,000 people.
It's so crazy.
It's a huge change. You're pulling into the street. There's cars in the driveway that weren't there. There's people that are unfamiliar with the house. You know, do you take their word that everybody's out when they don't even know, you know, who's there? Because there's 15 different families all staying in one house.
Right.
Sure.
You know, so it changes that whole mindset. And then, you know, then you just have the fact that access is more difficult and all those other things. You get down those little narrow side streets. We have some streets that, you know, we're lucky that we can fit the truck down once, let alone get the truck, lay a line from the hydrant, get the ladder down there, everything else. So
yeah, I mean, it was crazy obvious when I was, you know, we were there in August. I mean, your department, it was five calls and it was your department's gone, you know, like you know, it was it was nonstop calls all, you know. I mean,
you know, and that's, you know, like I said, and they're gone, and they're gone for 2 hours.
So I mean,
gone for 2 hours.
You know, you could tell the Cape is busy with just with the EMS. I can see the EMS burden manifest. I mean, ambulances, nonstop, up and down the highway. So
and that's, you know, where, you know, Provincetown. If you get hurt in Provincetown, it's a 40-minute transport.
Yeah,
that's
easy 40-minute, probably closer to an hour.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, that'd be a crazy place to do the job in. That's for sure.
Yeah. And, you know, and the other factor that comes with that is, you know, time and distance. You know, my first alarm for me to get everything there is probably 15 minutes.
Wow.
You know, and counting guys coming in from home, mutual aid, you know, even my auto response, they're not close. They're not coming because they're closer. Like most line responses, because it's closer to the address than the city or whatever. No, they're coming because they're supplemental help. So that's, but they could be 10 minutes away.
Sure.
You know, depending on what part of the district's in or whatever.
So what are some specific issues you've seen with training related to building construction? You kind of talked about this also, but for your department, you guys get acquired structures, right? And try to hit on some of that kind of stuff. Is there anything else that you've seen? Have you seen that a lack of understanding of building construction manifests itself on the fire ground, or are your guys pretty good at staying on top of stuff?
I don't think that I've seen a lack of construction. I think our guys are pretty well versed, and there's enough, you know, what this department has always had is a good core group of the middle seniority guys that have passed down the lessons, and they're usually involved in everything. So that I haven't seen as much. What I have seen, and this will touch on one of Chris's favorite topics, is I think I've seen a lack of appreciation for overhaul. You know, so like when I started, it was like you didn't stop pulling ceilings, you had clean, bare wood.
Sure.
Right? That was, didn't matter. If there was a little bit of char, if there was a little bit, you kept pulling until it was clean wood. And I've seen, you know, I've gone into a couple of fires, maybe not recently, but more recently, where, you know, you go into the room and there's a bunch of inspection holes, but, you know, 9/10 of the ceiling is still up. And it's like, well, they're not going to patch the holes, guys. Sure. Just pull it all down, get it down, and get rid of it. And then at least we know that, because that's a rekindle is my worst.
Yeah.
One of my worst nightmares. Not my worst nightmare, but.
Yeah, that's not just a dirty word, right? So.
It's not a rekindle. It's a second fire at the same location.
Yeah, you just didn't get the fire put out.
I tell people all the time, that is the biggest. So, you know, I started off in small town USA fire department, and I eventually wound up in a urban department. That was the biggest difference I found out of all the other differences that people think about. It was the overhaul mindset during the fire, you know, and just how they operated so differently and knew where the fire was going to be at, and just the skill that it took to know that. I was so just mind blown. I'm like, how did they know to go there, and these guys would always find the fire, and I had no idea how they did it. And it took me years to kind of understand the principles behind it. But yeah.
But the other piece of that is repetition.
Sure.
They know
yeah.
because they've done it before.
Sure.
Right? Mm-hmm. You know, so you know, and that's like, so how do you make up for that piece in the fire service? How do we overcome?
It's a $1 million question.
The biggest thing we're not going to solve it today,
but
lack of experience, yeah. right? And you can have the best trained guys. You can have guys that are going to classes, 100 class, but unless you're crawling down the hallway, feeling the tingle on your ears, knowing, hey, I got fire here, I got to look here, you know, mm-hmm. unless you're, and that comes from those cues happening sure. over and over again in real time.
And that's the thing is the candle's burning at both ends. You know, fires are doing this, and then we're in metal and concrete buildings, not doing that. So then where does that leave you?
So here's the total, like, atypical construction style. We have one 4-story apartment building in Harwich. Mm-hmm. It's condos right down on the water. It used to be an old hotel called the Belmont. And it's 6 4-story buildings. Mm-hmm. They are concrete floor, brick wall, non-sprinkled apartments.
Okay.
And it is one of my big, you asked me earlier, my big nightmare building. That's one of my big nightmare buildings because what I see in that is a Vandalia fire, the wind driven, could be a beautiful sunny summer day. Mm-hmm. It's right on the water, sure. 15 mile an hour southwest wind blowing into the apartment windows. And we're gonna open that apartment door and it's gonna be a blowtorch down the hallway.
Sure.
And that, mm-hmm. When I was a captain, my rule, my group was, we're stretching it 2.5 and we're stretching it from the street. It's standpipe, the building is. It actually has a sprinkler system in the parking garage. Mm-hmm. Which is weird. And it's one OSMY for both systems.
Okay.
So when you pump into the OSMY, you're pumping the sprinkler system and the standpipe. But my thing is, like, we don't do standpipe operations. So we're going to stretch 2.5 from the street because we can do that all day long.
Sure.
And I'm like, you know, go up to the lobby, throw a rope down, pull it up, whatever you got to do. I want it 2.5 in there because I want the water.
Sure.
And I want to do something we're familiar with. But that's our big nightmare building. And it's summertime's going to be occupied, you know, times 1,000 in. Everything else, we have a 35-foot height restriction. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing, you know, other than that, you know, we're looking at 2 stories, 2.5 tops. So
that's peculiar. What's the reasoning behind the height restriction?
Anti-Myrtle Beach.
Okay.
They didn't want the Myrtle Beach look of sure, all the condos. Sure.
Okay.
Water,
okay. I understand, you know, what you're saying.
Trying to keep like the historic part of the city.
Yep.
And,
exactly.
And that's cool because I mean that's, I tell people to get up there during the, you know, autumn because the environment's amazing. It's just amazing. Yep. Yeah, you don't see the Walmarts and the Targets and the Best Buys.
No.
What you see is just an incredible, you know, historical, you know, architecture.
Yep. And they, you know, they try really hard to keep it. A lot of historic districts here, they try really hard to keep it that way. You know, I was going through our building stock today and looking, you know, we have the oldest one I found was 1770.
Wow.
And what's cool is it's in an Irish pub that I worked at. It was called the Irish Pub. It's not an Irish pub. It's an old sea captain's house. And there's 3 houses on the property, and the pub itself was built in 1842, or actually in 1800. And I think that's a, I think they had a bunch of records that they didn't know, so they just rounded them to 1800. Mm-hmm. There's a sea captain's house behind the pub that was built in 1842. And then there's this little old stucco cottage next to the pub. And I mean, I've been in there, you know, we used to hang out after work and drink in there and everything else. And, That thing was built in 1770.
Yeah, that's incredible.
You would never
right?
know. It's like a craftsman style.
that's older than some people's state they live in. You know, I
mean,
I think
it's
thing
crazy.
About that. So yeah, I mean, that's the thing. The Midwest, we have room. You know, I mean, it's just a totally different reality when it comes to buildings that y'all have out there, which is, you know, why we're talking to you. But we're gonna go ahead and start wrapping this up.
Right.
I thank you for being here, and like I said, you know,
I appreciate the invite.
It's
actually
your time.
It's awesome to give your perspective on some stuff. You know, we talked about, you know, the Boston triple decker. You know, there's the Philly row home, then there's the Cape Cod, and you know, we got the Cape Cod, you know, chief here. So it worked out really good.
Yeah, I'm not sure they even originated down here. I don't know where. I mean, it's a Massachusetts house. I'm not sure that it originated on Cape Cod. I'm not sure how they became capes. Yeah. I'll probably doing some research now afterwards.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I'm sure I'll probably read more about. I don't know. I'm not a historical architect, you know. But I just know if I wanted to know about it, I'd start
this
there.
Old house did a bunch. Like if you watch some of the old this old houses, Norm Abrams did. They when they first started out back in the Bob Vila, they did a bunch of stuff on capes, and they talk all about them and show, you know, pure forms of what the original capes were.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the my understanding is they are always called capes. I don't think that they're always called Cape Cods. I think the cod got added afterwards, but I could be wrong. So it's, but you know, they're simple. You know, the stairs are opposite at the front door. You know, like every colonial I've ever been in, same thing. So it's, you know, that way they're bread and butter.
Yeah, I mean, it, what's crazy is, like you said, they brought that stuff to the Midwest. Most every small town has those in them. Very common in the town we live in. So,
you know, it's a great expandable floor plan. You know, when I started, when I built my first house, I built a straight face colonial. Mm-hmm. And my framer said, straight face colonial, most bang for the buck. It's two rectangles on top of each other. You get the maximum square footage. And, you know, what you lose with a cape is you lose some of that second floor square footage.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So that's what I always built. But, there, you know, it's that same, if you're building especially for expansion, it's great because you can build it and then finish the rest of your house off later. So it's, you know, kind of the frugal craftsman thing.
Awesome. Well, thank you. Awesome stories, awesome perspectives. So it was a great episode.
Great stuff. I appreciate the invite.
Yeah.
Thanks again.
All right. Take care.